Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A legend in the biker community, Peter Big Pete James was the most revered gangster in the outlaw nation. He first perfected his skills with the Hells Angels, the outlaws' chief rival, before persuading thousands of disgruntled members from splintered outlaws' chapters to unite. Together they formed a powerful criminal syndicate involved in extortion, contract murders, drugs and arms trafficking, money laundering, and assassinations. Then a shocking medical diagnosis knocked James sideways, forcing him to face a new life on the outside of the organization he built, dodging snitches, federal law enforcement, and contract hits. In The Last Chicago Boss, James provides a startling and unprecedented expose into the inner workings of the outlaw nation from the unique perspective of its renowned leader, all brought to life through never-before-revealed interviews, police files, wiretaps, recordings, and trial transcripts. The book you're featuring this evening is The Last Chicago Boss, My Life with the Chicago Outlaws, with my special guest, journalist, author, and attorney, Carrie Droben. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Carrie Droben.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much. Wonderful book. Again, incredible information, just when you think you've read it all. tell us a little bit how you came to, and please explain your background. I know that you're the co-author of Vagos, Mongols, and Outlaws, and Prodigal Father, Pagan Son, and Running with the Devil. You won a best memoir autobiography and a two-time winner for True Crime Award, for the True Crime Award. Tell us a little bit about your background, some of the books you've written, and why you say very early in the book that this is almost perhaps the culmination of your life's work. Tell us a little bit about what this book means to you and how you came to want to write this book. Tell us a little bit about that background.
Okay, sure. Well, I kind of fell into writing about motorcycle gangs. It was not something that I ever in a million years thought that I would pursue or write about. I started out as a novelist, and I had written two books, two fiction books, before I was approached by the undercover operative who was working for the ATF in Operation Black Biscuit, and that was the subject of my first book, Running with the Devil. It later became a landmark criminal investigation. It was the first ever infiltration of the Hells Angels by law enforcement. And it was a book that, or project, that I turned down three times. I had no experience. I had no agent. I had never written true crime before. And I had no background even in journalism. As I said, I was a novelist and a lawyer. So I didn't really have a concept of how big a deal this original book was and how tremendous a project it was going to be. And so I approached it sort of as ignorance is bliss at the time. And I began just sort of, I hit the ground running, and I started doing interviews with the operatives involved. And ironically, I realized halfway through that even though I had turned down this project, I really was probably exactly the right person to write that book. And I was primed for writing all their other outlaw motorcycle books, because I grew up living in an undercover world. My parents both were covert, and so I was already living an undercover life. And at the time, I was married to a detective, homicide detective, who worked largely undercover. And so my whole life at the time was very much living a double life. So I could relate very well to the operatives in Operation Black Biscuit. And so I was actually, I mean, that book sort of set that the framework for my later work. And so when I finished Running with the Devil and the odyssey that created, I had somebody say to me, you know, don't be surprised if you get approached by someone from a rival gang who wants you to write their story from the inside. And at the time, I thought that was, you know, hilarious. And in fact, that is exactly what happened. And I was approached by Anthony Mangini, who is LT in the book Prodigal Father, Pagan Son. And he was born into what he called, he describes as born into madness. And so he was born into the organized crime family where his father was the founder of the Pagans motorcycle gang. And they are one of the chief rivals. They're one of the big five. And so he asked me to write his story. And then, and ironically enough, after that book came out, Charles Falco, who is the subject of Vagos, Mongols, and Outlaws, read Running with the Devil and came to me and asked me to write his story. So they sort of really sort of piggybacked on each other. And Big Pete, ironically enough, his clubhouse, his Northside clubhouse, was prominently featured in Vagos, Mongols, and Outlaws. And Charles Falco, who was an infiltrator, had actually been and attended parties at Big Pete's clubhouse. So when Peter James, a.k.a. Big Pete, read Vagos, Mongols, and Outlaws, he identified that, and he called me up and he said, you know, I have a story. I was the boss of the Chicago Outlaws, and I'd like you to write my story. So everything sort of, you know, piggybacked from Running with the Devil, and I developed a niche and an expertise in this area, and that's how I came to write these books. And so to answer your question, how is this the culmination of my life's work? Well, Big Pete's book and his story, it took about 2 years to interview him, research it, and write the book, and it took a lot out of me. And I realized, you know, in working with Peter James, he was a phenomenal character, just a master storyteller, very funny person. And through the course of my interviews with him, I learned not only so much about the Chicago Outlaws, the gang lifestyle, motorcycle gangs, 1%er gangs, but I also learned an awful lot about myself and, you know, what compelled me to write in this kind of underworld that I was very familiar with. So it was a really fascinating journey.
Certainly, certainly. Now, you start off by talking about Big Pete, and he grew up with a couple siblings in a small town outside on the outskirts of Wisconsin. So tell us a little bit about his early life and his early influences.
Yeah, so what's particularly extraordinary about Big Pete is that he knew from probably the age of seven, maybe even before that, that he wanted to be the boss of Chicago. Not necessarily the boss of the Chicago Outlaws, but the boss of the city of Chicago. And this is a pretty extraordinary statement for somebody that grew up in a suburb. He grew up in a pretty modest family, didn't have a lot of money, but he was the first of his siblings who attended college. He joined a fraternity, he played football, he had aspirations once upon a time to be in politics. He was a very smart, kind of cunning person. But what really influenced him was he had read The Godfather from a very early age. The Godfather was like his Bible, and he had read it, you know, at least seven times before he was 21. And he had highlighted various passages and could quote from it. And that was really a huge influence for him. He also was very influenced by his uncle, who went to Marquette, and he was a very well-educated man. He was a businessman originally, and he went to school to become a CPA. But what happened with his uncle was his uncle sort of introduced him to the glamorous lifestyle of Chicago. He would show up periodically and take him into the city, and Pete just fell in love with Chicago. In fact, in the book, I kind of equate Chicago to it's almost a metaphorical mistress for him. It was somewhat of a just a magical, fantastical place, and his uncle really personified that for him and showed him that this was the life he could have. So his uncle eventually winds up finding his life in the horse races. And so he kind of quasi introduces him to that underworld, and Pete is mesmerized by it. So he's influenced by that. He's also influenced that one of the really interesting things I found in this book is here's this family who's very, very close to. They play board games as children, and that's their form of their major form of entertainment. So they played Risk and the Chinese game Go. They played Monopoly. And so through the board games, and this is really how I framed his memoir, he learned how to, use pawns to move across the board and put people in checkmate. He learned how to take over territories by playing the game Risk. He learned about properties and boundaries from playing Monopoly. And so these were all huge influences in his life, and really sort of led him. He says in the book that everything he did in his life led him one step closer to his goal of becoming boss. And he saw the outlaws as a vehicle to become the boss. So it wasn't necessarily that he wanted to join a biker gang, because as his story progresses, you can see how he's become the leader of almost every, I want to say prototype of what ultimately he would become. So he becomes a frat leader, for example, and he learns how to, manipulate the frat brothers that he has. He becomes an Order of the Moose when he joins the Moose Lodge. So everything that he does, even, forms his own clubs, he's, Every step he takes is a step toward becoming basically the CEO of a criminal organization and becoming the boss of Chicago.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's almost comedic, but it isn't, in that he goes to this, what you would think, Moose Lodge, pretty innocent place, and he, as you write, he brings in 35 of his friends and indoctrinates him into the Loyal Order of Moose, so he gets 35 votes, and later Pete is the governor of the Loyal Order of this Moose. So he starts in humble beginnings, but he has the same plan always, and it's conquer and get what he wants and be the boss. So you also talk about that he realizes that education is a key, and so it's not incongruous to be a tough guy but also be educated. And also he talks about his love of football, or at least his skill in football. So what does his athletic ability, at least at that time, and his idea that education is important, what does he do with that?
Well, I think he realizes early on, and I think he really could have been anything that he wanted to be. He could have been a lawyer. He could have been. He jokes. I don't know that he's joking. Actually, I think he's perhaps serious. That if he had not been the boss of the Chicago Outlaws, he might have been a televangelist. Because what he realizes early on is that with education, knowledge is power, and he can manipulate, what he perceives as underlings, people that are not as smart as he is or not as cunning as he is. And so, as he rises in the ranks, he finds vehicles, a.k.a. the Chicago Outlaws, to elevate him and to give him some kind of clout in the world of the mob, the outfit, and in the world of basically being able to corral 38 other clubs to be under his umbrella. So he sees education as a way to get power and a way to manipulate, I guess, is a better way to say it. But he's basically manipulating people that are not as smart as he is or as cunning as he is. And the whole idea that he plays in football is, again, it's employing the whole metaphor of gamesmanship, because he is almost, some people refer to him in the book as the gentleman gangster, because he's very fair, he's very smart, but in the end, he always gets what he wants. And so in football, everything is rules, and you have rules of engagement, and you play by the rules, and each person has their own position in the game. And, you know, he would argue that it's positions of hierarchy, you know, so not, you know, each member of the team, you operate as an ensemble, but each team member has their specific duties and role. And so that's very much akin to what it was like to run an outlaw motorcycle organization. There's rules and hierarchies and rank and file, and everyone operates as an ensemble, right? All for one, one for all. But everybody knows, you know, where they are in the pecking order, and everyone knows the rules of the game.
You talk about in this about the what adios means to Outlaw Nation. So tell us about the state of the rivalry that we talked about in the introduction when we talk about the Hells Angels. Tell us what that time, what did Big Pete, what was the reality of the situation between the Outlaws and the Hells Angels at that time in Chicago?
So adios means angels die in outlaw states. And so the war that was going on in the early 90s and was sort of trying to be perpetuated in during Pete's reign is that angels did not have territory in Chicago. That was an outlaw nation. And so the whole war and the whole battle that continues to be fought between these outlaw motorcycle gangs is a battle for turf. And turf, of course, gives you prowess in the drug trade, in the arms trade, and in all of these other, you know, under-the-radar enterprises. So it's very important for the outlaws to maintain that control and that territory. And that's the whole objective of the game. So you have when the outlaws changed considerably since the early 90s, and Pete's reign went from the 90s to about 2015. The core values remained the same, but during the early 90s, there was a movement to defend turf against the Hells Angels, and so Chicago was, there was like a warlike frenzy going on. It was a hunter-prey mentality, and there was even this sort of mantra, cripple or kill the enemy. And so at the time in the 90s, there was this movement to convert the Hell's henchmen who already had a foothold in Chicago. They were going to convert them to the Hell's Angels. So the outlaws were opposed to the Angels establishing a Midwest presence, and so they aggressively protected their territory. And in 1994, Taco Bowman, who was the Outlaws International president, and he's now serving life in prison, he led the charge when he ordered the outlaw regional boss at that time to bomb the Hell's henchmen. And so there were a number of firebombings that went on, and it was, you know, the outlaws had a presence in Chicago that, you know, they were known as this dangerous, reckless group of, you know, hellions that were firebombing things just to keep the Hell's henchmen from encroaching on their territory and obviously the Hell's Angels. So what happened during Pete's reign was very interesting because Pete says often in his book that, you know, if you're building an army and there isn't a war, then your soldiers are going to become lax. And so, you know, what was happening was he was having meetings and runs, you know, runs were events that were organized by the outlaws, and there would be outlaws who would either be late to the meetings, not show up at all, or ask Pete, you know, could we skip this week because I have to take my old lady out for a Valentine's Day, you know, event. So it was almost diluting the presence of the outlaws because there wasn't a real war. So what Pete had to do, which was comedic and also functional, was he had to invent a fake war. So he would corral the outlaws on a weekly basis, and he would go hunting, and he would hunt for Hell's Angels. Hell's Angels that, by the way, did not exist in the places that he took this group of outlaws to. So he would convince the outlaws that he was training, that Hell's Angels were everywhere, they were encroaching in on their territory, they had to go to these various bars and scout them out. So they would wind up in brawls with mostly Polish community. It had nothing to do with Hell's Angels at all. But he had to keep that image going and that persona going. And so there are a number of very funny scenes, I think, in Last Chicago Boss that really highlight that, including this whole crazy excursion to Sturgis where, you know, they're surrounded by Hell's Angels. They think they're surrounded by Hell's Angels and they're going to be bombed at any moment or sniped. And it's just not the reality. But they have to keep that illusion up in order to keep the whole goal and objective, the whole reason for the Outlaws to exist is to defend their territory. So if there isn't anything to defend, then, you know, they cease to become this dangerous, powerful presence in Chicago.
What is different with Pete's philosophy in terms of rivals and in terms of recruiting and in terms of, again, what they call puppet clubs, support clubs? What is his philosophy, and if it's different than past presidents' philosophies?
Well, Pete has a brilliant idea, actually, that his philosophy is, you know, we want to be inclusive, not exclusive. And so traditionally, the Outlaws and actually many biker gangs traditionally have been exclusive. They've been very, you know, they've been accused of being white supremacist. They certainly don't allow women into their clubs, can't hold positions of power or positions of office. And so Pete saw this as a detriment. He believed that if you include every club, then you have some modicum of control over everyone. So he had women in positions, you know, he formed this confederation of clubs. So women were not members of the Outlaws, but they held positions like secretary in the confederation of clubs, which was unheard of because Outlaws did not answer to women. And so that was one you know, thing that he completely dissected and changed. The other thing he did was he corralled a host of African-American clubs that were under his umbrella. And he had this real ability to, he just had such charisma and charm that he was able to get these clubs to follow him. And so, and that's, it's really unprecedented in the biker culture to do that. So he had, he wanted to dispel that myth that the Outlaws were a white supremacist organization. But mostly the reason he did it was he believed that if you didn't, you know, clubs were going to form anyway. And he had them approach him almost on a weekly basis saying, you know, we want to form a club. And so they had to get Pete's approval to form a club because Pete was the boss. So if Pete said no, these clubs would form anyway. They would go underground and he would have no control over them. And that is, in fact, what happened to one of the clubs that's described in the book, where they become rogue clubs. And when they're rogues, then they become a threat. So Pete's idea was get them all under his wing so he could at least know who the players were, know what they were up to, what territories they controlled, and he would be able to control them and manipulate them as, you know, as needed. So it was a very smart move on his part, and it was unprecedented. And I think even he would say, you know, the core values of the Outlaws were the same throughout, but that was one way that he splintered off and was able to really gain a foothold and tremendous power in the city of Chicago.
To maintain that power comes some brutal behavior. And you also talk about that where the HA have, Hell's Angels have no specific clubhouses, there had been a federal raid, 11 outlaw arrests, 94 prosecutions, which included 12 murders, 3 assassinations. Just describe some of this for people that are getting a little bit caught up in the charm and charisma of Big Pete, some of the stuff that, just the descriptions of some of the murders that you have in this book, some of the stuff was incredible.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that is a common misperception. There's a public and a private persona that the Outlaws and in fact, most outlaw biker gangs will have, and that's because they don't, you know, they don't want the public's opinion. It's sort of the, you know, they want to be popular in the public opinion poll. But what actually goes on here in order to capture this territory and turf, they're not, you know, huddling in negotiations at a meeting and deciding, you know, who's going to control what areas. in the 90s, this was particularly prevalent under Taco Bowman's rule. They would have just horrific murders where it was almost execution style. There's one I think described in the book where the body is dragged, body of a woman actually is dragged for miles until parts of her start to fall off and, you know, into the roadway. And so there's no end really to the brutality or the brutal measures that they will take to maintain their turf. I mean, everything from fire bombings to executions to, you know, like I described, the bodies being dragged across the roadways. There was a, when the outlaws go to Sturgis, as described in the book, they hear of just somebody being gunned down while they're getting an ice cream cone at, you know, a convenience store. So it was that random and that brutal. And so the presence and the fear of, you know, being sniped or being hunted down was definitely real. And there are mentions, you know, there's this, I mean, it's written in a comedic style, but really what happens is Pete has, you know, he describes it as basket number one and basket number two. And so basket number one are problems that are handled, and they can be handled easily without, you know, any hint of violence. Basket number two requires more, you know, stronger measures. And so the implication with basket number two problem children are they need a heavier hand. And so sometimes that heavy hand is going to result in beatings. And the beatings, you know, I think Pete's phrase is, you know, you don't have a good brawl or a good beating until somebody goes to the hospital. And so that's really what happened at these. You know, Pete would round up his soldiers or his recruits, and they would go to different bars in Chicago, and they would just start brawls. And the bar fights were not what you and I might think of as a bar fight. These were bar fights where people almost died during the bar fights, you know, and so people would go to the hospital. There were, you know, heads were stomped on. I mean, so that is really part of the culture of the biker culture. And so I think it's a bit of a misnomer where the public is so enamored with the biker culture. I mean, I know, like Sons of Anarchy, for example, glamorized in some parts the biker culture in the same way that maybe The Sopranos did. But, you know, TV right. and reality are very different. And so, sure. So yeah, that's really what's going on behind the scenes.
You talked about just in continuance of that idea that what was very, very surprising to me is the extent of that idea that it's a glamorous lifestyle to the point where there's Big Pete's talking about all these altercations that with police officers and actually bike clubs called Rebel Knights, where there's police officers and sergeants and people working in organized crime in these clubs. And so tell us, as you do, and it's incredible, that Pete is negotiating with and in associations with police officers that are in motorcycle clubs. Incredible.
Yeah, and this is the very odd thing about this, and I've encountered this a lot, It makes sense to me only from this perspective, is that there is a glamour associated with being a part of a club, okay? And there's a huge distinction between club and gang, and I can get into that in a minute. But so there are law enforcement personnel who will join biker clubs, and the biker clubs are very, very – so they have very similar trappings to the outlaw motorcycle gangs that they are actually trying to control and cripple. So what happens in Chicago and in Big Pete's book is that he befriends a lot of the police officers because his mantra is, again, it's better to have, you know, cops that are friends rather than being friendly to cops. And what he means by that is that, you know, the cops needed the outlaws in order to control the crime. Okay, this is a very strange symbiotic relationship, but the cops actually welcome them in. You know, it's sort of like different kinds of snakes, right? You want what is it, the king snake, I think, that eats the rattlesnake or something. I mean, that's kind of what that relationship was. So the cops needed the outlaws in certain areas in order to control the crime. The outlaws needed the cops in those areas so that they could continue to work in their criminal activities and have the cops turn a blind eye. And so this was very prevalent, and I describe it in the book, particularly with one group of police department and one shift. It was a night shift. And these police officers were, they turned a blind eye to the outlaws, but not to the point where they shunned them. They actually wanted to be a part of them. And so Rebel Knights is a cop motorcycle group that, you know, espouses things. You know, we are a club. We just like to ride motorcycles. We enjoy motorcycle riding. And that's what they have in common with outlaw biker groups. The difference is, as they would argue, is that one engages in criminal activity and the other does not. But the very strange thing about that is it's a fine line, because if you even go on their websites, you can see the similarities. They have bylaws in the Constitution. They have club dues, club rules. They have a members-only roster. They don't allow women in. I think that some of the cop clubs now may allow women in, but not in positions of power. Even down to some of the music that is on the different websites. It's very interesting and strange, but if you look at outlaw biker gangs, they borrow the rank and file and hierarchy structure from the military, as do police agencies. So they're borrowing from very similar systems, but one is warping it and the other is not. And I kind of leave that up to their readers' discretion as to whether or not that's the case, because there's a very fine line. In fact, there's a scene in the book I describe where the police officers have several tattoos, which, you know, identify them with their particular police club. And they were getting in trouble or reprimanded by their police agencies for having these tattoos because it was difficult to differentiate the police officers from the gangsters. And so that's also very, very similar to what happens in biker gangs. You know, you'll have the tattoos identifying them to the particular biker gangs. You know, they all have to have a certain type of motorcycle. They all have to follow a certain rank and file. They all have rules. So it's fascinating. And I think Pete's book highlights that more than any of my other books, although I'm certain it's prevalent in other biker gangs as well.
You also talk about another fascinating element of this also, and that I've read about this before, but not to this extent, about the probates. And so Pete talks about himself being a probate, and I couldn't believe the stuff he had to say. We're talking about who's your daddy kind of thing. So if you could, and he becomes a probationary member of the Outlaws at 43 years old, so he's not really young. So tell us about what the probates really mean, what that can entail, and if you could, just give us a little bit of this daddy dialogue that I was in the book.
So, well, probates are very similar to, you know, if you're a member of a fraternity, for example. I mean, I think the biker gang is really like a criminal fraternity. So you've got brothers, and there are brothers that are sponsored in. So probates are the bottom of the rank. And when you want to become a member of the Outlaws motorcycle gang, you have to start at the bottom. And you have to probate for at least 6 months. There's really not a minimum requirement. Some will probate for years before they're actually sponsored in. So a probate will have a sponsor who's usually already a member. Well, they have to be a member of the Outlaws gang or biker gang. Sometimes they're, in Pete's case, he was sponsored by a regional boss, which is not normal, but that's what happened. So when you probate, very similar to a fraternity where you're going in as a pledge and you're prospecting for that particular fraternity. So Pete was probating for the Outlaws. So you have to envision this. So Pete has already been the top of every organization that he's formed or been a member of. So he was the top of his fraternity. He was the governor of the Moose. He had his own club prior to being an outlaw, which was called the Loyal Order. He was the president of the Loyal Order. So he was already primed to be an outlaw because that was his goal. But he still had to start at the bottom. So he was, and he has this wonderful scene. So Big Pete is big, okay? He's larger than life, and he's also a very large man. And so he describes it as he was actually protected somewhat because of his size. So the other big members took him under his wing and sort of, you know, pulled him aside and didn't have him do a lot of the real grunt work that a lot of the probates do. But essentially, they work as slaves. I mean, they have to be at the beck and call of any member to do whatever. So some, for example, will have to stand hours and hours in tremendous heat without any water or food or anything, and they'll stand for, you know, 24 hours or more just because they're supposed to guard motorcycles. But the thing that Pete describes is they're emasculated, so they're not even given a name. They're not identified by name, so they're identified as probate. Or if they're asked, you know, the thing that you're describing is, who's your daddy? So he had to basically say, you know, my daddy is, you know, whoever his sponsor was. And so people couldn't believe that he had a regional boss sponsoring him, so they didn't believe him when he said, you know, my daddy is so-and-so. And so then they would make fun of him. They'd say, you know, he'd say, my name is Big Pete. And they'd say, well, we're going to call you Peter Pan, you know, or Petey. And so they would try to emasculate him, and that's really similar to hazing. So the whole purpose of probating is to break you down so that if you can't make it through the probationary period, then you can't make it as an outlaw. So, you know, in addition to trying to dehydrate people, they will, you know, make you serve them beer. They'll make you stand behind the bar. And sometimes you're in the middle of a, you know, a fight that happens and you get beaten up. There are a number of scenes like that where he's somewhat protected because he's big and he's pulled aside, but he's also subjected to the emasculation of, you know, these other members, which is very difficult for Pete, as you can imagine, because he's used to being in a position of power.
We're going to use this as an opportunity, Carrie, just to stop for a second to talk about the sponsor of our program, which is Movement MVMT Watches. MVMT Watches, pronounced Movement, was founded on the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. The watchmaker's goal is to change the way consumers think about fashion by offering high-quality, minimalist products at revolutionary prices. With over 1 million watches sold to customers in over 160 countries around the world, MVMT Watches has solidified itself as the world's fastest-growing watch company. The company started by two broke college kids that wanted to wear stylish watches but couldn't afford them, so they started their own watch company. And all their success has been online, basically very much like myself. I received my Movement watch after looking at their impressive line of watches on their website, and I chose the classic black gold, and I was very, very impressed. I have some nice watches. I had an important wedding to go to, September 17th, which was my wedding, and I chose to wear this watch, and it looked great. It's, as I say, classic black gold. It's really a beautiful watch. These watches start at $95, and at a department store, you're probably looking at $400 to $500. Movement figured out by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and the retail markup, providing the best possible price. It's got classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism. Over 1 million watches sold in over 160 countries. Get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to mvmt.com/murder. This watch has a really clean design. Seriously, I've been getting compliments ever since I put it on. And now is the time to step up your watch game. Go to mvmt.com/murder. Join the movement. Carrie, we were talking about Big Pete and his ascension in the Chicago Outlaws. Let's talk about some more serious stuff just to demonstrate, as you do in the book, his power, the seriousness of the situation, their ongoing fight with the Hells Angels. When you talk about the Odium swap meet in Chicagoland, tell us about what they thought this was, how this thing turns into something much worse, and also explaining the people that think that they can be neutral and not be involved in the fight between outlaws and Hell's Angels.
Okay, so the Odium swap meet was, swap meets were a big opportunity for the outlaws to really not only showcase who they were as a show of force and a presence in Chicago, but it was also to show any potential rival gangs that they were the boss. So they had the Odium swap meet was a big deal, and it was the sponsor or the person that was organizing the Odium swap meet traditionally always knew that this was an outlaw venue, and so you know they would be prepared for the outlaws to appear at this venue. And what happened during this particular Odium swap meet was the outlaws were not prepared. And so what they encountered when they arrived was they had to stand in line like the others in order to get into the swap meet. And the reason that it turned into a disaster was because it was spearheaded by a person by the name of Santa, who's identified in the book. And he doesn't know, he's kind of operating it from the framework of a corporate entity instead of, you know, we're a criminal syndicate. So he's trying to follow the rules as if he was a corporate player. So he stands in line and he tells Big Pete, you know, we have to stand in line. We have to check our weapons at the door, you know, all of this stuff. So he's trying to play by the rules of, you know, the square world, the quote unquote square world, which isn't how it operates inside the Odium swap meet. So Pete knows the score and he knows what's about to happen. And so they arrive, a day after everything's been set up. So all the booths have already been set up in the Odium swap meet. And so Pete knows that if the booths have already been set up, then whoever's setting up those booths, a.k.a. Hell's Angels, could stash weapons under, you know, the venue or the booths. So he's already prepared, and he tries to prepare his men, you know, the people from his club, that this could potentially happen. And they don't have anything. They're not armed except with pocket knives. So one of the members of their group winds up just creating kind of chaos in the swap meet because he's trying to find the weapons. He's trying to uncover whatever, you know, ambush they're about to happen. And sure enough, they do get ambushed. And one of the members gets stabbed. And so at this, and then of course they flee because they don't want to be there when the police arrive. But what happens at this swap meet is Pete encounters a group that is not affiliated with any particular turf. So they want to be neutral. And there's no such thing in Chicago as to be neutral because you have to align yourself with either the outlaws, aka one of the subsidiary groups who is part of the Confederation, is also part of the outlaws and under the outlaws' wing, or you're just going to be flying solo. And if you're flying solo, you're just open to be attacked, and you're not going to have any defense. Nobody's going to come to your aid. So it's really impossible to be a neutral club. And Pete demonstrates this because one of the members who, you know, of this neutral party is gets stabbed, you know, or sees the stabbing. And he comes to Pete after the swap meet, and he knocks on Pete's door, and he's just frantic, and he says, you know, okay, we don't want to be neutral anymore. We want to join the outlaws. And Pete slams the door in his face, and he says, you know what, it's too late. You've already aligned yourself as a neutral party, so you're on your own. So it really emphasizes the danger of being individual. You can't be individual in this world. You have to conform, and you have to conform to the criminal syndicate that controls the entire city. So it's pretty eye-opening because everyone has their faction. I mean, either you're part of the outfit or the mob, or you're part of the outlaws, or you're part of that group of 38 clubs that is under the Confederation, under AKA the outlaws.
Yeah, you said that Pete took his cue from the Chicago outfit, the Mafia, who sometimes chopped up bodies and disposed of the remains as fertilizer. You do talk about, or Pete talks about, some of the things he does to avoid arrest, and he has a partner named Bastardo.
Yes.
Again, probably ample naming of that guy. So, and also you talk about this LAMA and another cop, and also another talk about neutral ground. So if you could tell us a little bit about Pete and his idea and his influence from the outfit.
Well, Pete is very closely aligned with the outfit. He used to do, prior to him becoming the boss, the outfit used the outlaws to do a lot of their dirty work. So they used them as their muscle. They were kind of soldiers. And so Pete gained entry into the outfit, or he gained respect from the outfit by doing some of that work. And some of that included being sort of the tax man and going and collecting debts for the outfit. So he would go and drive up to people's houses and take all of their property, but he was very polite about it. He would say, I'm taking this, and he would leave. Sometimes he would leave $100 for the remains, so that they wouldn't be completely destitute. So, again, gentleman gangster, but so he was able to work his way into the outfit to at least get some respect from them. So he took that cue because you can't have any rogues in this culture. There can't be an independent, there can't be a neutral. So the Llama group was, again, a group of, it was the, I forget what it stands for now, Latin Motorcycle Association. But they didn't want any part of the outlaws. They didn't want to be controlled by them. And they kept showing up at this venue that, again, was predominantly the outlaw venue. And so when they showed up the first time, Pete warned the president of the Llama group. He said, you can't come here again. This is my turf. And he told the owner of that venue that they were not to have the Llama group there, because this was, again, outlaw turf. So he gave him a pass the first time. The second time he shows up and the Llamas are there again. And this time he says, we're going to have a brawl, because this is our turf and you're not listening to us. And so there would be instances where he encountered the Llama members. He didn't have it at that venue out of respect for that owner, because that's what the outfit would do, right? They wouldn't create a scene at that place. So what happens later on when he encounters a Llama member, that's when the threat becomes real, and that's when the fight becomes real, and the Llama member goes home and he's got, a broken nose, or he's completely beaten up, or he threatens him and says, you're going to find, a body part of yours. If you don't watch out, we'll cut off your ear and have that as warning not to encroach on outlaw turf.
Now, you talk about other close calls for Big Pete in terms of law enforcement making any kind of arrests, infiltrating this gang at all, or getting any kind of intelligence on him to make any kind of arrest. But you do talk about a couple close calls, and you do talk about this vehicle that is found with blood spatter. Tell us a little bit about that. What do people, or what do police ascertain from that or surmise from that?
Well, Pete is very careful to never be the person who actually does any of the criminal activity. So like a mob boss, he removes himself from the actual crimes that are happening. And so a couple of things that he does, which again is taken from the mafia, is he will send an underling out, or he'll send Bastardo out to do his dirty work or do his bidding, and he will use code language, and he'll say, it's kind of going back to the basket number two thing. Well, he'll say, we're going to get the white van, and, I don't want to know any details. I don't want to know too much information, but whatever you have to do, I just want you to report back to me that the job has been done. So that's how he removes himself from the actual activity. So when law enforcement, and he's very careful to never be record it. That was his big thing. I don't ever want to hear my voice on tape, because that means that I've been surveilled and that I've, given out information. So he cautions his crew, the outlaws that are in his club or in his chapter, that they're not to speak in regular language. So he'll say things to Bastardo like, has how was the cheeseburger, or how was the, you know, is the hamburger well done, you know, and things like that, so that he's never caught in that kind of scenario. So when the feds do surveil him, in fact, he describes, I mean, it's really quite crazy that there are several instances where Pete knows that the federal surveillance van is across the street from him, watching him, but he's never caught in anything because he's never the one doing it. His hands are never dirty. So he'll be the one that delegates. He'll be the one that follows up, but he's always removed from the scene. There's one particular case that the feds are watching pretty closely where Pete installs gambling machines in different clubhouses, but he's very careful to never install one in his own clubhouse. So when the feds are surveilling this activity or this gambling activity, Pete's very confident that he's never going to get pulled into it because he doesn't have one in his own clubhouse. You know, he's not the one that's, you know, his hands aren't dirty. In other words, other people are doing it. So, you know, and he'll caution them. You know, he'll say, well, you know, he'll use code language when they're collecting money from the gambling machine. So it's all very well orchestrated and very well masterminded. And that's how he keeps himself separate. So when the feds, you know, will find a van with blood in it, they can never trace it back to Pete because he's not directly in it.
You talk about, you mentioned it, again, it's almost comedic, the police escorting the outlaws because they think they might be ambushed at Sturgis. And you say Pete travels with a Mac-10 357 Magnum 40 caliber Glock. Tell us about this almost comedic thing where the police have to protect them and what they think might happen. Because it is very, very interesting. Before we talk about the murder of one of his sidekicks, Hojo.
So Sturgis is this, it's famous, very famous motorcycle rally. You know, anyone who's anybody shows up at Sturgis. And so the outlaws, of course, showed up, but they weren't allowed to enter Sturgis. So the police, you know, they had to get a campground that was outside of Sturgis. And the reason they couldn't enter Sturgis, there was a murder that had happened very close to Sturgis, and so there was all kinds of surveillance and police around the area, and so the outlaws kept to themselves in this campground, and they believed for, you know, several days that they were going to be ambushed or sniped by the Hells Angels because they didn't have a lot of information. They didn't know what had actually happened or transpired. They just knew that something had happened up the road from them in Sturgis, so they never actually got to Sturgis. So on one particular, you know, outing where they were allowed out of their campground, they were escorted by police to a neighboring town. Again, not Sturgis, just a neighboring town where they could get pizza and you know, there wasn't even anything to do in this neighboring town. It was kind of a ridiculous outing, but I describe it in the book, and this is exactly how it happened. They got on all of their gang, you know, regalia. They wore all of their outlaw insignia. They got onto their bikes, and they were going to show a real show of force. They were all going to ride in packs and get to this neighboring town. And so there's this tremendous show of force. The police escort them there, and the police, you know, pick them up and take them back. But on the way back, Pete is leading this pack, and he runs into a deer. And the deer is the force of his motorcycle sends the deer into a ditch, and Pete's motorcycle is a little bit, you know, messed up. So he pulls off to the side of the road. He's in the ditch. It's starting to get nightfall, and he tells the rest of his group, you know, go on ahead. I'm going to wait here. I'm going to fix my bike. But he's alone in this ditch, and his thought pattern is, oh my God, you know, I'm a moving target for any Hell's Angel sniper. I'm just sitting out here in a ditch with a dead deer, and nobody from his pack stays with him. In fact, they're all whizzing by him, and they say, you know, we have to get back to the campground before nightfall. So nobody's with him, and so finally, Pete Pete just decides, you know, there's no way he's going to be a sitting duck for the Hells Angels. So he waves down a police officer, and the police officer says, you know, well, you killed a deer. You know, you can get a ticket for that out here because, you know, you're not allowed to kill a deer. So the whole scenario is very absurd, that here's Pete worried about getting sniped by a Hells Angel. The cop is about to write him a ticket for killing a deer. And then Pete turns it around and he says, well, if you're going to write me a ticket, I need to get back to my campsite safely, and so I'm going to need a police escort. And he flips it around, and the police wind up escorting him back to his campground so that Pete is not sniped by, you know, a Hell's Angel that might be lingering in the bushes or the woods. So that's an excellent example of how cunning and smart and manipulative Pete is, because he's going to use a situation to his advantage, and he certainly did in this very, it's actually a very hilarious scene in the book, but he flips it around, you know, and gets what he wants out of it.
You talk about, in the beginning, his different philosophy, not more inclusive, obviously, and non-discriminatory towards all kinds of people, rather have that than have division. How successfully was he in uniting the street gangs and motorcycle clubs not affiliated with the Outlaws or the HA, Hells Angels? And was there any opposition from other outlaws to what he was doing?
He was extremely successful in getting these 38 other clubs, many of whom were African-American clubs, Polish clubs, I mean, clubs that the Outlaws would just absolutely hands down shun. Pete got them under his wing. He was the head of the Confederation of Clubs, and he was a mastermind at that. He would have meetings there where all of these 38 club members would show up, and they would listen to him speak. So he was extremely successful at that, but he did get a lot of flack from his own for that, because they didn't want to, first of all, they didn't want to answer to a woman. Second of all, they didn't want to answer to, you know, any member of a Polish club. They didn't want to answer to African Americans. But he was able to master this. And so even though his own club members, the Outlaws, did not want to be a part of the National Confederation of Clubs, because of this, you know, they started to dwindle, he stayed in that position of power. So even though he got flack, he was able to maintain that power. And I think his reasoning for the Outlaws was, again, we don't want rogue clubs. We want them to support us. The more people that support us, the more scouts, so to speak, you have. You know, people that are aligned with the Outlaws will keep the others at bay. They'll keep the Hells Angels out, because ultimately that was the huge goal of keeping the Hells Angels out. But he did have, you know, splinter groups within these 38 clubs that didn't want to follow Pete, and that was a problem for him to contend with. So there was a Polish club in particular that, you know, splintered off, and when Pete eventually, I mean, at first he denied them clubship when they could form a club. They went off and became a rogue club. So there was always that threat that people weren't going to follow him or going to form their own clubs. And so that's what he was always contending with. But he was enormously successful at getting these clubs under his wing. And that again, is very unprecedented, that there's not been anyone else in the history of outlaw motorcycle gangs that has been able to accomplish that or do that.
There was, though, in the course of this book, it seemed that despite anything, he had a growing dissatisfaction with the leadership in Outlaw Nation and some of his underlings, himself and other chapters. So what was it his main criticism of these other chapters, and what did he think was lacking?
What was lacking in them was an ability to to be a part of a team. There were definitely ones that would go off and be their own. You know, they wanted to either form their own leadership or have their own, way of handling things. And so there was one in particular. There were really outlaw chapters that he was having to contend with on multiple levels. There were leaders that were not really leaders anymore. They were sort of, you know, holding down full-time jobs. They were outlaws, you know, sometime or part-time outlaws. And some of them weren't ready to follow anything they did. Some of them weren't even based in Chicago. They were based in the suburbs. So he was having a hard time contending with them. You know, after a while, where he would have meetings and, you know, ask other outlaw chapters to attend, they would start to dwindle off. They would say they had other functions to do. And so, you know, eventually there's a point in the book where he says, you know, becoming an outlaw is a lifestyle. It's not something that you do part-time. It's not something that you do whenever you feel like it. You know, you have to commit to this. So he was having trouble with some of the leaders of some of these chapters committing to not only him, but the whole value system in the outlaws. And so I think that was part of his issue.
To put a face on it, like very much like the beloved Sopranos that we mentioned, Big Pete has a life outside of the motorcycle club, the gang, organized crime, as it were, and that person being his wife, Debbie. Tell us a little bit about their relationship and who Debbie was in real life before she entered into this world with Pete.
Debbie provides a really fascinating perspective on what it's like to be not only married to the boss, but also a female in this outlaw biker culture. And so Debbie comes from the corporate world. She has a college degree, a master's degree. She's in IT. She absolutely has no background at all in the biker culture. So what's fascinating about her is that she says she wants very much to support Pete in his endeavors. No matter what he wants to do, she's there to support him. And that gives her a lot of pleasure and a lot of, you know, personal satisfaction. And so she writes in there that, in the book, that while the public perspective or perception of being a female in the biker culture is they're treated worse than dogs, she had a personal goal. She wanted to be respected in this misogynistic world. She wanted to be respected as the best old lady they had ever seen. And to her, that would give her enormous satisfaction, because not only would she be supporting Pete, but she would be breaking the mold, so to speak. So she thrust herself into being the property of, or the old lady of, Big Pete, which is really a fascinating perspective. Now, Pete absolutely adores Debbie. And that is very evident throughout the book. And so for him to balance what it means to be a boss, right, where he's constantly being barraged by women, wanting to be not only, you know, to have sex with him, but to introduce him to things that, you know, I'm sure Debbie would not be happy with, Pete's always having to balance that. So, and he does that quite well in this world, because his devotion and his love is always for Debbie. And that never wavers, either before he becomes an outlaw or even when he's an outlaw. And so he's always in the role. And in fact, at one point he tells her, you know, you can't come to these parties anymore because I can't protect you. So, you know, he treats her as an equal. But in the biker culture, women are not equal. Women are not even classified as people in most scenarios. But Debbie lends a completely different perspective on that. And she introduces, she actually says in the book that she feels more comfortable in the biker world than she did in her corporate world. And it's because she has something that she needs to prove.
Now, there's some things that happen, like we talk about all the close calls, and then there's this dramatic moment where somebody named Pinky, and you can tell our audience who Pinky is, and the relationship he has with Big Pete. But there's a phone call where she starts it with, "I may have said some things." Tell us a little bit about this phone call and what it leads to.
So Big Pete is very enterprising during this whole time that he's the boss of the Outlaws. He's involved in all kinds of different business dealings, the escort business, the, you know, anything that will help him make some money, he's involved in. So Pinky is somebody that he is involved in. He's making, I think it's Swarovski crystals. He's helping to back it or finance it. So that's how he initially meets Pinky. And Pinky goes on and she has this business where she's making bandanas with the Swarovski crystals on the bandanas, and she's trying to market it to the bikers. And so Pete's involvement in that is he's trying to back it and trying to recoup a piece of the profit, but she's really, you know, spearheading the business. But she calls him up at one point and says, I'm going to Florida for a vacation. Is there anybody down in Florida that I can stay with or that you can hook me up with? So he does. He hooks her up with, you know, some of his friends. And so that's the last he hears of it. But Pinky gets involved in she's trying to sell drugs to, and she winds up selling them or engaging in drug activity with an undercover. And so as part of her plea bargaining or her deal to get a lesser sentence, a lesser repercussion, she gives up Pete. She says, you know, I happen to know Big Pete. So when she makes this phone call to Pete, she says, you know, I may have said a few things to this undercover guy. I mean, this is how she describes it to Pete. And so Pete, you know, of course, has gone ballistic, because not only does he have a double problem, he's got, you know, the feds potentially on his back, even though Pete hasn't done anything. He doesn't know what Pinky has told them. And second of all, he doesn't want Debbie to find out about Pinky. You know, he doesn't want her to think that something else was going on with Pinky that wasn't going on. So he's right. Got this whole thing going on in his head for this. But the feds do wind up showing up unannounced, and they arrest Debbie. And they arrest her for drug charges. And it's just ludicrous and, you know, nonsensical. But they arrest her, and she winds up spending some time in jail in Florida for charges that make absolutely no sense. And so Pete is beside himself and has to, you know, figure out a way to get not only the charges dropped, but Debbie out of jail. And he almost, you know, has what's tantamount to a nervous breakdown to try to rectify this and get her out, because she's the last person in the world that would ever have any criminal charges or anything to do with drug activity. So that's his close call with the feds, and P.S., he wins that. The case gets dropped, and, you know, it's been a complete mistaken identity case, and Debbie's released from jail, and the feds wind up paying Pete money for their mistake. So it's just a crazy whirlwind, but it's an irony that he almost doesn't recover from. You know, here he's led his entire life very, you know, close, holding secrets close to the vest, never, you know, getting arrested for anything, having a great rapport with the police and the feds, and the last person he ever expects to turn on him is Pinky. You know, it's almost like that famous line, you know, a woman can bring you down. And so that's what happens in this case, and it's pretty ironic.
Yeah, you describe very much, it's almost like the Sopranos scene when they come to the Soprano home. There's a big knock on the door, federal task force, guns drawn, dressed in full battle gear, as you write, Kevlar vests, helmets, plastic shields, and they arrest Debbie, but it's drug possession of 2 Vicodin pills.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit overdone, we'll say.
Yes, overkill. It's crazy. And it's because of who Pete is. And they're trying, the feds, it's almost like a cat and mouse game where the feds have always wanted to get Pete on something, and they've never been able to get him on anything. And they thought that this was their big coup, their big opportunity to, you know, snag Debbie on something, and then it would lead to something that Pete was involved in. And of course it didn't. It wound up being this, you know, complete circus, complete overkill, and Debbie wasn't involved in it at all.
Now, in the midst of all of this, we say that, you know, you say, you're right, normally what would happen is, obviously, people in this lifestyle get killed or they get arrested, and that didn't happen with Big Pete. Tell us what happens and what does he do? What's his reaction to the news?
Well, Pete, and Pete would say this, I think, that he's lived a charmed life. He's lived very carefully, very calculatingly. He achieved his goal and his dream in life, which was to be the boss of Chicago. But what brings him down is something that he cannot control, he would never have expected, and he's helpless to defend against, and it's cancer. So when he learns that he has kidney cancer, he's devastated by the news because he realizes that it's the end of the road for him. You know, not necessarily because it's terminal, which it is, but because he will not be able to lead the way that he did because he's going to have to go through medical procedures and he's going to be relegated to a position of having to be subservient, which is not what he's used to. And the real irony of that scene where he learns that he's got kidney cancer is the book opens where he is sort of in the waiting area of the regional boss, Greece, who's been shot. And Greece has to convalesce for many months after the shooting. He's never the same. And so it's an interesting, almost an ironic twist at the end that Pete finds himself in the same position. And so when the book opens with Greece, many of the regional bosses are trying to discuss what to do with the problem of Greece, because you can't have somebody in a position of power who has to be on medical leave. So Pete is asked to step down. He's asked to resign because he can't lead and also go to all of these treatments for his cancer. And that's really devastating for him. So he does it gradually, and he says, you know what, I'm going to be back. You know, this isn't the end. I'm going to be back. And so he appoints two people in positions of power, and he specifically picks people that he knows will not do a good job. And he does that on purpose because he doesn't want to be replaced. And he tells these two people, you know, I want you to report to me what's going on. So he thinks he can lead virtually, you know. And what happens, of course, is the two people that he appoints don't report back to him. He starts to lose control of the people that he's appointed. He doesn't know what's going on at the parties anymore. And so he's distanced more and more because of his illness. And the regional bosses come to him and they say, you know, well, we want you to maintain or still be in control of the COC, which is the Confederation of Clubs, the 38 clubs that he's gotten under his wing, but we don't want you to be the boss of this outlaw chapter because you can't be that. So for a while, Pete tries to do that as well, and then he finally appoints somebody to take over that position because he just can't do it anymore. And so it's a very interesting, you know, almost de-escalation of power, and it's an interesting close to the chapter of his life. And when he started to tell me his story, it was a very interesting experience because, you know, he came to me and he said, you know, I want to tell you my story. I am dying. I don't know when I'm going to die, but I'm dying, and I want to make sure that the truth gets out there. So it was sort of like, you know, a priest taking a confessional, and it was an extraordinary experience, and it was also very moving for me because it's hard for me to, you know, I felt like I had a huge responsibility to tell the story the way that he wanted it told because he was not going to be here for very much longer. And so it sped up the process for me of interviewing him and making sure that I got the book done and out before he died so that he could approve of it. So it was sort of his last gasp, you know, to tell me everything, get it out on paper, and make sure that his life story was preserved.
Before we talk a little bit more about that last wish, his death wish, that the truth come out, he talks about, again, ironically, one of these members is named Judas, and the 15 outlaws who burst into a group called Twisted Images. Tell us what this retribution was and who was in front of and why Big Pete, despite his murderous background, would not approve of this and criticized this event.
Twisted Image was one of the groups that Pete had gotten under his wing, under the 38, and he had befriended the leader of Twisted Images. And they were throwing a party, and they did not invite the outlaws, which is really, you know, it's kind of sacrilegious, you know, not to do that. But it was a party where he had family members and he had his young children there at the party. And so because the outlaws were snubbed, Judas, who was the leader of that of Peach chapter at that time, and yes, it's ironic that his name is Judas, and he lived up to his name, but he went and invited himself, and he crashed the party. And so when he got to the party, he took the leader of Twisted Images, and he beat him to a pulp, almost killed him, but he beat him unconscious in front of his daughter, who I think at the time was 7. And so Twisted Image, the leader of Twisted Images, called up Pete and said, they're brutalizing me, they're here, you have to do something about it. And Pete was in a very interesting position because even though he was friends with this leader of Twisted Image, he could not disagree with what Judas had done. He couldn't disagree that the outlaws needed to show their presence, they needed to get retribution for being snubbed from this party. So he was not against what Judas had done and bringing his barrage of people there to beat up the leader. What he couldn't stand and what was so difficult for him to accept was that the beating happened in front of the child. Pete had his own, you know, code of ethics, and he really despised people that hurt women and children. And he had a soft spot for, you know, single moms or, you know, children particularly, because he had such an adoration for his own mother. So while he agreed with what Judas did, he disagreed with how he did it, he could not have any type of retribution against Judas, because then he would be going against his own in favor and in support of this support club, Twisted Images. So it was a really interesting, almost symbolic of everything that Pete stood for and everything he needed to continue to stand for in order to be revered and respected in his own outlaw community.
What did Big Pete feel about this book? What was his take on this? What was his impression?
He was overwhelmed and extremely grateful for the book. He was extremely thankful that his story got out, and he, to this day, we are still friends. And he, during the writing of the book, it was interesting because the very first thing he did when the book got accepted by St. Martin's was he sent me a dozen roses. And he said, you know, I don't really know quite what to give to an author. He said, if you had given a performance on stage and had done an amazing performance, you would give the performer roses. You know, that's how he equated it. So he sent me roses. And then during the writing of the book, he would send, you know, Godiva chocolates. And he sent me Chicago pizza because he wanted me to experience Chicago, because I'd never been to Chicago. And so, you know, through the whole writing of it, he was very respectful, very grateful, very considerate of the whole project, because he was a fascinating person to interview, very funny, very smart. But, you know, even he has said often, he's like, you know, I can be difficult. But I actually didn't find him difficult. I found him very refreshing in a lot of ways. But so, you know, towards the end of this, when the book actually came out, he was just so overwhelmed. He wrote to me, he said, I couldn't even imagine what it would be like to see not only his picture on the front cover, but to see his life story memorialized the way that it was. So he was very happy with it.
You talk about that you did form a fierce friendship full of poetry, confession, and heart. What did he respect the most about what you had done, in terms of, was there a realism that he saw in this book, an honest depiction of outlaw lifestyle that he hadn't seen before, not only an honest depiction of his life and his role in the outlaws, but also a more realistic depiction by virtue of the work you did and the work he did to help you do that?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think he wanted to kind of shatter the myth in some ways. I mean, he loved being an outlaw. He loved being the boss of the Chicago Outlaws, and he, you know, he still upheld all of the core values of what the biker gang represented to him. But he was very disillusioned by the biker gang toward the later years of his life in that gang, because not behaving the way that he really believed that they should behave, or that they originally behaved when Taco Bowman was leading the charge. And he was very disappointed by that and disillusioned by that. I mean, they weren't out there, you know, hunting Hell's Angels. They weren't really personifying the brutality, in his mind, that they used to do. So he wanted to show what the Outlaws really had become, which was, you know, this band of misfits that were gathering together, that were almost play-acting being outlaws rather than being outlaws. And so he was very disappointed in that. And I think his hope would always be that they would return to the bloodthirsty warrior-like people that they once were. And I think his realization, or his sad reality, was that maybe they never would be that again, because everything has changed now. You know, everything that the old outlaws really had to reform and transform and to become something else. And he was disappointed and disillusioned that they had not become that. So I think this book for him was, you know, a satisfaction that he was getting that out there. He didn't want there to be a misperception anymore. He wanted it to be an accurate rendition of who the Outlaws were.
It's definitely, he is a very, very complex figure, and very, some things seem to be almost incongruous with each other, but he is definitely a larger-than-life character, and you have definitely brought that to the reader. An incredible story, and of course, mm-hmm. all of the adventures that are his reign as Outlaw Nation president and leader are very, very are captured incredibly in your book. I want to thank you very much, Gary Drobin, for coming on and talking about The Last Chicago Boss, My Life with the Chicago Outlaws. For those people that might want to contact you or see some of your other work, do you have a Facebook page, website? Tell us about how people might be able to contact you.
Yeah, the best way to contact me would be through my website. It's just my name, carriedrobin.com, and that will lead to all of the other links to my other social media, Facebook, and my other books.
Well, thank you very much, Carrie. It's been a very, it's been a big pleasure. Thank you very much, and hope
thank
to talk to you
much.
Again soon. Thank you.
Thank you so
Good
much.
Night.
Bye-bye.